This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. Narrated by George Guidel. The author begins this book with the following introduction. Science fiction is often described and even defined as extrapolative. The science fiction writer is supposed to take a trend or phenomenon of the here and now, purify and intensify it for dramatic effect, and extend it into the future. If this goes on, this is what will happen. A prediction is made. Method and results much resemble those of a scientist who feeds large doses of a purified and concentrated food additive to mice in order to predict what may happen to people who eat it in small quantities for a long time. The outcome seems almost inevitably to be cancer. So does the outcome of extrapolation. Strictly extrapolative works of science fiction generally arrive about where the Club of Rome arrives, somewhere between the gradual extinction of human liberty and the total extinction of terrestrial life. This may explain why many people who do not read science fiction describe it as escapist, but when questioned further, admit they don't read it because it's so depressing. Almost anything carried to its logical extreme becomes depressing, if not carcinogenic. Fortunately, though extrapolation is an element in science fiction, it isn't the name of the game by any means. It's far too rationalist and simplistic to satisfy the imaginative mind, whether the writers or the readers. Variables are the spice of life. This book is not extrapolative. If you like, you can read it, and a lot of other science fiction, as a thought experiment. Let's say, says Mary Shelley, that a young doctor creates a human being in his laboratory. Let's say, says Philip K. Dick, that the Allies lost the Second World War. Let's say this or that is such and so, and see what happens. In a story so conceived, the moral complexity proper to the modern novel need not be sacrificed, nor is there any built-in dead end. Thought and intuition can move freely within bounds set only by the terms of the experiment, which may be very large indeed. The purpose of a thought experiment, as the term was used by Schrödinger and other physicists, is not to predict the future. Indeed, Schrödinger's most famous thought experiment goes to show that the future, on the quantum level, cannot be predicted, but to describe reality, the present world. Science fiction is not predictive. It is descriptive. Predictions are uttered by prophets, free of charge, by clairvoyants, who usually charge a fee and are therefore more honored in their day than prophets, and by futurologists, salaried. Prediction is the business of prophets, clairvoyants, and futurologists. It is not the business of novelists. A novelist's business is lying. The Weather Bureau will tell you what next Tuesday will be like, and the Rand Corporation will tell you what the 21st century will be like. I don't recommend that you turn to the writers of fiction for such information. It's none of their business. All they're trying to do is tell you what they're like, and what you're like, what's going on, what the weather is now, today, this moment, the rain, the sunlight. Look, open your eyes, listen, listen. That is what the novelists say. But they don't tell you what you will see and hear. All they can tell you is what they have seen and heard in their time in this world, a third of it spent in sleep and dreaming, another third of it spent in telling lies. The truth against the world. Yes, certainly. Fiction writers, at least in their braver moments, do desire the truth, to know it, speak it, serve it. But they go about it in a peculiar and devious way, which consists in inventing persons, places, and events which never did and never will exist or occur, and telling about these fictions in detail and at length and with a great deal of emotion, and then when they're done writing down this pack of lies, they say, there, that's the truth. They may use all kinds of facts to support their tissue of lies. They may describe the Marshalsea prison, which was a real place, or the Battle of Borodino, which really was fought, or the process of cloning, which really takes place in laboratories, or the deterioration of a personality, which is described in real textbooks of psychology, and so on. This weight of verifiable place-event phenomenon behavior makes the reader forget that he's reading a pure invention, a history that never took place anywhere but in that unlocalizable region, the author's mind. In fact, while we read a novel, we are insane, bonkers. We believe in the existence of people who aren't there. We hear their voices. We watch the Battle of Borodino with them. We may even become Napoleon. Sanity returns, in most cases, when the book is closed. Is it any wonder that no truly respectable society has ever trusted its artists? But our society, being troubled and bewildered, seeking guidance, sometimes puts an entirely mistaken trust in its artists, using them as prophets and futurologists. I don't say that artists cannot be seers, inspired, that the Awen cannot come upon them and the gods speak through them. Who would be an artist if they didn't believe that that happens? If they did not know it happens because they have felt the god within them use their tongue, their hands, maybe only once in their lives, but once is enough. Nor would I say that the artist alone is so burdened and so privileged. The scientist is another who prepares, who makes ready, working day and night, sleeping and awake, for inspiration. As Pythagoras knew, the god may speak in the forms of geometry as well as in the shapes of dreams, in the harmony of pure thought as well as in the harmony of sounds, in numbers as well as in words. But it is words that make the trouble and confusion. We are asked now to consider words as useful in only one way, as signs. Our philosophers, some of them, would have us agree that a word, sentence, statement, has value only insofar as it has one single meaning, points to one fact that is comprehensible to the rational intellect, logically sound, and, ideally, quantifiable. Apollo, the god of light, of reason, of proportion, harmony, number. Apollo blinds those who press too close in worship. Don't look straight at the sun. Go into a dark bar for a bit and have a beer with Dionysus every now and then. I talk about the gods. I am an atheist. But I am an artist, too, and therefore a liar. Distrust everything I say. I am telling the truth. The only truth I can understand or express is, logically defined, a lie. Psychologically defined, a symbol. Aesthetically defined, a metaphor. Oh, it's lovely to be invited to participate in futurological congresses where systems science displays its grand apocalyptic graphs, to be asked to tell the newspapers what America will be like in 2001 and all that, but it's a terrible mistake. I write science fiction, and science fiction isn't about the future. I don't know any more about the future than you do, and very likely less. This book is not about the future. Yes, it begins by announcing that it's set in the ecumenical year 1490-97, but surely you don't believe that. Yes, indeed, the people in it are androgynous, but that doesn't mean that I'm predicting that in a millennium or so we will all be androgynous, or announcing that I think we damn well ought to be androgynous. I'm merely observing, in the peculiar, devious, and thought-experimental manner proper to science fiction, that if you look at us at certain odd times of day, in certain weathers, we already are. I am not predicting or prescribing. I am describing. I am describing certain aspects of psychological reality in the novelist's way, which is by inventing elaborately circumstantial lies. In reading a novel, any novel, we have to know perfectly well that the whole thing is nonsense, and then, while reading, believe every word of it. Finally, when we're done with it, we may find, if it's a good novel, that we're a bit different from what we were before we read it, that we have been changed a little, as if by having met a new face, crossed a street we never crossed before. But it's very hard to say just what we learned, how we were changed. The artist deals with what cannot be said in words. The artist whose medium is fiction does this in words. The novelist says in words what cannot be said in words. Words can be used thus paradoxically because they have, along with a semiotic usage, a symbolic or metaphoric usage. They also have a sound, a fact the linguistic positivists take no interest in. A sentence or paragraph is like a chord or harmonic sequence in music. Its meaning may be more clearly understood by the attentive ear, even though it is read in silence, than by the attentive intellect. All fiction is metaphor. Science fiction is metaphor. What sets it apart from older forms of fiction seems to be its use of new metaphors, drawn from certain great dominants of our contemporary life, science, all the sciences, and technology, and the relativistic and the historical outlook among them. Space travel is one of these metaphors. So is an alternative society, an alternative biology. The future is another. The future in fiction is a metaphor. A metaphor for what? If I could have said it non-metaphorically, I would not have written all these words, this novel, and Genly I would never have sat down at my desk and used up my ink and typewriter ribbon in informing me and you, rather solemnly, that the truth is a matter of the imagination. Ursula K. Le Guin.
And now, The Left Hand of Darkness.
Chapter 1. A Parade in Herrenrang. From the Archives of Hain, transcript of Ansible document 01-011101-934-2-Geffen. To the Stabil on Olul, report from Genly I, first mobile on Geffen slash winter, Hainish cycle 93, ecumenical year 1490-97. I'll make my report as if I told a story, for I was taught as a child on my homeworld that truth is a matter of the imagination. The soundest fact may fail or prevail in the style of its telling, like that singular organic jewel of our seas, which grows brighter as one woman wears it, and, worn by another, dulls and goes to dust. Facts are no more solid, coherent, round, and real than pearls are. But both are sensitive. The story is not all mine, nor told by me alone. Indeed, I'm not sure whose story it is. You can judge better, but it is all one. And if at moments the facts seem to alter with an altered voice, why then, you can choose the fact you like best. Yet none of them is false, and it is all one story. It starts on the 44th diurnal of the year 1491, which on the planet Winter, in the nation Karhide, was Odarahad Tua, or the 22nd day of the third month of spring in the year one. It is always the year one here, only the dating of every past and future year changes each New Year's Day as one counts backwards or forwards from the unitary now. So it was spring of the year one in Erhenrang, capital city of Karhide, and I was in peril of my life and did not know it. I was in a parade. I walked just behind the Gossiwars and just before the king. It was raining. Rain clouds over dark towers, rain falling in deep streets, a dark, storm-beaten city of stone, through which one vein of gold winds slowly. First come merchants, potentates, and artisans of the city Erhenrang, rank after rank, magnificently clothed, advancing through the rain as comfortably as fish through the sea. Their faces are keen and calm. They do not march in step. This is a parade with no soldiers, not even imitation soldiers. Next come the lords and mayors and representatives, one person or five or 45 or 400, from each domain and co-domain of Karhide, a vast ornate procession that moves to the music of metal horns and hollow blocks of bone and wood, and the dry, pure lilting of electric flutes. The various banners of the great domains tangle in a rain-beaten confusion of color with the yellow pennants that bedeck the way. And the various musics of each group clash and interweave in many rhythms echoing in the deep stone street. Next, a troop of jugglers with polished spheres of gold, which they hurl up high in flashing flights and catch and hurl again, making fountain jets of bright jugglery. Or at once, as if they had literally caught the light, the gold spheres blaze bright as glass. The sun is breaking through. Next, 40 men in yellow playing gasewars. The gasewar, played only in the king's presence, produces a preposterous, disconsolate bellow. 40 of them played together shake one's reason. Shake the towers of Erinrang, shake down a last spatter of rain from the windy clouds. If this is the royal music, no wonder the kings of Karhide are all mad. Next, the royal party, guards and functionaries and dignitaries of the city and the court, deputies, senators, chancellors, ambassadors, lords of the kingdom, none of them keeping step or rank, yet walking with great dignity. And among them is King Argovan XV, in white tunic and shirt and breeches, with leggings of saffron leather and a peaked yellow cap. A gold finger ring is his only adornment and sign of office. Behind this group, 8 sturdy fellows bear the royal litter, rough with yellow sapphires in which no king has ridden for centuries, a ceremonial relic of the very long ago. By the litter walk 8 guards armed with foray guns, also relics of a more barbaric past, but not empty ones, being loaded with pellets of soft iron. Death walks behind the king. Behind Death come the students of the artisan schools, the colleges, the trades, and the king's hearths, long lines of children and young people in white and red and gold and green, and finally, a number of soft-running, slow, dark cars end the parade. The royal party, myself among them, gather on a platform of new timbers beside the unfinished arch of the river gate. The occasion of the parade is the completion of that arch, which completes the new road and river port of Erinrang, a great operation of dredging and building and road-making that has taken 5 years, and will distinguish Argovan XV's reign in the annals of Karhide. We are all squeezed rather tight on the platform in our damp and massive finery. The rain is gone, the sun shines on us, the splendid, radiant, traitorous sun of winter. I remark to the person on my left, "It's hot. It's really hot." The person on my left, a stocky, dark Kahider with sleek and heavy hair, wearing a heavy overtunic of green leather worked with gold, and a heavy white shirt and heavy breeches, and a neck chain of heavy silver links, a hand broad. This person, sweating heavily, replies, "So it is." All about us as we stand jammed on our platform lie the faces of the people of the city, upturned like a shoal of brown, round pebbles, mica glittering with thousands of watching eyes. Now the king ascends a gangplank of raw timbers that leads from the platform up to the top of the arch, whose unjoined piers tower over crown and wharves and river. As he mounts, the crowd stirs and speaks in a vast murmur, "Argovan!" He makes no response. They expect none. Gasewars blow a thunderous, discordant blast. Cease. Silence. The sun shines on city, river, crowd, and king. Masons below have set an electric winch going, and as the king mounts higher, the keystone of the arch goes up past him in its sling, is raised, settled, and fitted almost soundlessly, great ton-weight block though it is, into the gap between the two piers, making them one thing, an arch. A mason with trowel and bucket awaits the king up on the scaffolding. All the other workmen descend by rope ladders like a swarm of fleas. The king and the mason kneel, high between the river and the sun, on their bit of planking. Taking the trowel, the king begins to mortar the long joints of the keystone. He does not dab at it and give the trowel back to the mason, but sets to work methodically. The cement he uses is a pinkish color, different from the rest of the mortar work, and after 5 or 10 minutes of watching the King Bee work, I asked the person on my left, "Are your keystones always set in a red cement?" "For the same color is plain around the keystone of each arch of the old ridge, which soars beautifully over the river upstream from the arch." Wiping sweat from his dark forehead, the man, I must say, having said he and his, the man answers, "Very long ago, a keystone was always set in with a mortar of ground bones mixed with blood. Human bones, human blood. Without the blood bond, the arch would fall, you see. We use the blood of animals these days." So he often speaks, frank yet cautious, ironic, as if always aware that I see and judge as an alien. A singular awareness in one of so isolate a race, and so high a rank. He is one of the most powerful men in the country. I'm not sure of the proper historical equivalent of his position, vizier or prime minister or counselor. The Karhaitish word for it means the king's ear. He is lord of a domain and lord of the kingdom, a mover of great events. His name is Therem Harth Rem-ir Esraven. The king seems to be finished with his masonry work, and I rejoice. But crossing under the rise of the arch on his spiderweb of planks, he starts in on the other side of the keystone, which after all has two sides. It doesn't do to be impatient in Karhide. They are anything but a phlegmatic people, yet they are obdurate. They are pertinacious. They finish plastering joints. The crowds on the Cess embankment are content to watch the king work, but I am bored and hot. I have never before been hot on winter. I never will be again, yet I fail to appreciate the event. I am dressed for the ice age, and not for the sunshine, in layers and layers of clothing, woven plant fiber, artificial fiber, fur, leather, a massive armor against the cold, within which I now wilt like a radish leaf. For distraction, I look at the crowds and the other paraders drawn up around the platform, their domain and clan banners hanging still and bright in sunlight, and idly I ask Estraven what this banner is, that one, and the other. He knows each one I ask about, though there are hundreds, some from remote domains, hearths and triblets of the Pairing Storm Border and Kermland. "I'm from Kermland myself," he says when I admire his knowledge. "Anyhow, it's my business to know the domains. They are Karhide. To govern this land is to govern its lords. Not that it's ever been done. Do you know the saying, Karhide is not a nation, but a family quarrel?" I haven't, and I suspect that Estraven made it up. It has his stamp. At this point, another member of the Curamy, the upper chamber or parliament that Estraven heads, pushes and squeezes a way up close to him and begins talking to him. This is the king's cousin, Pemer Harj Rem-ir-Taib. His voice is very low as he speaks to Estraven, his posture faintly insolent, his smile frequent. Estraven, sweating like ice in the sun, stays slick and cold as ice, answering Taib's murmurs aloud in a tone whose commonplace politeness makes the other look rather a fool. I listen, as I watch the king grouting away, but understand nothing except the animosity between Taib and Estraven. It's nothing to do with me in any case, and I am simply interested in the behavior of these people who rule a nation in the old-fashioned sense, who govern the fortunes of 20 million other people. Power has become so subtle and complex a thing in the ways taken by the Ecumen that only a subtle mind can watch it work. Here it is still limited, still visible. In Estraven, for instance, one feels the man's power as an augmentation of his character. He cannot make an empty gesture or say a word that is not listened to. He knows it, and the knowledge gives him more reality than most people own. A solidness of being, a substantiality, a human grandeur. Nothing succeeds like success. I don't trust Estraven, whose motives are forever obscure. I don't like him. Yet I feel and respond to his authority as surely as I do to the warmth of the sun. Even as I think this, the world's sun dims between clouds regathering, and soon a flaw of rain runs sparse and hard upriver, spattering the crowds on the embankment, darkening the sky. As the king comes down the gangplank, the light breaks through a last time, and his white figure and the great arch stand out a moment vivid and splendid against the storm-darkened south. The clouds close. A cold wind comes tearing up Port and Palace Street. The river goes gray, the trees on the embankment shudder. The parade is over. Half an hour later, it is snowing. As the king's car drove off up Port and Palace Street and the crowds began to move like a rocky shingle rolled by a slow tide, Estravan turned to me again and said, "Will you have supper with me tonight, Mr. I?" I accepted with more surprise than pleasure. Estravan had done a great deal for me in the last 6 or 8 months, but I did not expect or desire such a show of personal favor as an invitation to his house. Hardrem Ir Taib was still close to us, overhearing, and I felt that he was meant to overhear. Annoyed by this sense of effeminate intrigue, I got off the platform and lost myself in the mob, crouching and slouching somewhat to do so. I'm not much taller than the Gathenian norm, but the difference is most noticeable in a crowd. "That's him. Look, there's the envoy." Of course, that was part of my job. But it was a part that got harder, not easier, as time went on. More and more often I longed for anonymity, for sameness. I craved to be like everybody else. A couple of blocks up Brewery Street, I turned off towards my lodgings, and suddenly, there where the crowd thinned out, found Taib walking beside me. "A flawless event," said the king's cousin, smiling at me. His long, clean yellow teeth appeared and disappeared in a yellow face all webbed, though he was not an old man, with fine, soft wrinkles. "A good augury for the success of the new port," I said. "Yes, indeed." More teeth. "The ceremony at the Keystone is most impressive." "Yes, indeed. That ceremony descends to us from very long ago. But no doubt Lord Estravan explained all that to you." "Lord Estravan is most obliging." I was trying to speak insipidly, yet everything I said to Taib seemed to take on a double meaning. "Oh, very much indeed," said Taib. "Indeed, Lord Estravan is famous for his kindness to foreigners." He smiled again, and every tooth seemed to have a meaning, double, multiple, 32 different meanings. "Few foreigners are so foreign as I, Lord Taib. I am very grateful for kindnesses." "Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And gratitude's a noble, rare emotion, much praised by the poets. Rare above all here in Erenrang, no doubt because it's impracticable. This is a hard age we live in, an ungrateful age. Things aren't as they were in our grandparents' days, are they?" "I scarcely know, sir, but I've heard the same lament in other worlds." Taib stared at me for some while, as if establishing lunacy. Then he brought out the long yellow teeth. "Ah, yes, yes indeed. I keep forgetting that you come from another planet. But of course that's not a matter you ever forget. Though no doubt life would be much sounder and simpler and safer for you here in Erenrang if you could forget it. Eh? Yes indeed. Here's my car. I had it wait here out of the way. I'd like to offer to drive you to your island, but must forego the privilege, as I'm due at the king's house very shortly. And poor relations must be in good time, as the saying is, eh? Yes, indeed." As the king's cousin, climbing into his little black electric car, teeth bared across his shoulder at me, eyes veiled by a net of wrinkles. I walked on home to my island. Karhosh Island, the usual word for the apartment boarding house buildings that house the greatest part of the urban populations of Karhide. Islands contain 20 to 200 private rooms. Meals are communal. Some are run as hotels, others as cooperative communes, others combine these types. They are certainly an urban adaptation of the fundamental Karhidish institution of the hearth, though lacking, of course, the topical and genealogical stability of the hearth. Its front garden was revealed now that the last of the winter snow had melted, and the winter doors 10 feet above ground were sealed off for a few months, till the autumn and the deep snow should return. Around at the side of the building, in the mud and the ice and the quick, soft, rank spring growth of the garden, a young couple stood talking. Their right hands were clasped. They were in the first phase of Kemmer. The large, soft snow danced about them as they stood barefoot in the icy mud, hands clasped, eyes all for each other. Spring on winter. I had dinner at my island, and at 4th hour, striking on the gongs of Remney Tower, I was at the palace ready for supper. Karheiders eat 4 solid meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, supper, along with a lot of adventitious nibbling and gobbling in between. There are no large meat animals on winter, and no mammalian products, milk, butter, or cheese. The only high-protein, high-carbohydrate foods are the various kinds of eggs, fish, nuts, and the Hainish grains. A low-grade diet for a bitter climate, and one must refuel often. I had got used to eating, as it seemed, every few minutes. It wasn't until later in that year that I discovered the Gathenians have perfected the technique not only of perpetually stuffing, but also of indefinitely starving. The snow still fell, a mild spring blizzard, much pleasanter than the relentless rain of the thaw just past. I made my way to and through the palace in the quiet and pale darkness of snowfall, losing my way only once. The palace of Erenrang is an inner city, a walled wilderness of palaces, towers, gardens, courtyards, cloisters, roofed bridgeways, roofless tunnel walks, small forests and dungeon keeps, the product of centuries of paranoia on a grand scale. Over it all rise the grim, red, elaborate walls of the royal house, which, though in perpetual use, is inhabited by no one beside the king himself. Everyone else, servants, staff, lords, ministers, parliamentarians, guards, or whatever, sleeps in another palace or fort or keep or barracks or house inside the walls. Estraven's house, sign of the king's high favor, was the corner red dwelling, built 440 years ago for Harmes, beloved Kemmering of Emran III, whose beauty is still celebrated, and who was abducted, mutilated, and rendered imbecile by hirelings of the Innerland faction. Emran III died 40 years after, still wreaking vengeance on his unhappy country. Emran the ill-fated. The tragedy is so old that its horror has leached away, and only a certain air of faithlessness and melancholy clings to the stones and shadows of the house. The garden was small and walled. Sarum trees leaned over a rocky pool. In dim shafts of light from the windows of the house I saw snowflakes and the thread-like white spore cases of the trees falling softly together onto the dark water. Estraven stood waiting for me, bareheaded and coatless in the cold, watching that small, secret, ceaseless descent of snow and seeds in the night. He greeted me quietly and brought me into the house. There were no other guests. I wondered at this, but we went to table at once, and one does not talk business while eating. Besides, my wonder was diverted to the meal, which was superb. Even the eternal bread apples transmuted by a cook whose art I heartily praised. After supper, by the fire, we drank hot beer. On a world where a common table implement is a little device with which you crack the ice that has formed on your drink between draughts, hot beer is a thing you come to appreciate. Estraven had conversed amiably at table. Now sitting across the hearth from me, he was quiet. Though I had been nearly 2 years on winter, I was still far from being able to see the people of the planet through their own eyes. I tried to, but my efforts took the form of self-consciously seeing a Gathenian first as a man, then as a woman, forcing him into those categories so irrelevant to his nature and so essential to my own. Thus, as I sipped my smoking sour beer, I thought that at table Estraven's performance had been womanly, all charm and tact and lack of substance, specious and adroit. Was it, in fact, perhaps this soft, supple femininity that I disliked and distrusted in him? For it was impossible to think of him as a woman, that dark, ironic, powerful presence near me in the firelit darkness, and yet whenever I thought of him as a man, I felt a sense of falseness, of imposture. In him, or in my own attitude towards him? His voice was soft and rather resonant, but not deep. Scarcely a man's voice, but scarcely a woman's voice either. But what was it saying? "I'm sorry," he was saying, "that I've had to forestall for so long this pleasure of having you in my house, and to that extent at least I'm glad there is no longer any question of patronage between us." I puzzled at this a while. He had certainly been my patron in court until now. Did he mean that the audience he had arranged for me with the king tomorrow had raised me to an equality with himself? "I don't think I follow you," I said. At that he was silent, evidently also puzzled. "Well, you understand," he said at last, "being here, you understand that I am no longer acting on your behalf, with the king, of course." He spoke as if ashamed of me, not of himself. Clearly there was a significance in his invitation and my acceptance of it that I had missed. But my blunder was in manners, his in morals. All I thought at first was that I had been right all along not to trust Estravan. He was not merely adroit, and not merely powerful, he was faithless. All these months in Erinrang it had been he who listened to me, who answered my questions, sent physicians and engineers to verify the alienness of my physique and my ship, introduced me to people I needed to know, and gradually elevated me from my first-year status as a highly imaginative monster to my present recognition as the mysterious envoy, about to be received by the king. Now, having got me up on that dangerous eminence, he suddenly and coolly announced he was withdrawing his support. "You've led me to rely on you. It was ill done." "Do you mean that, having arranged this audience, you haven't spoken in favor of my mission to the king, as you—" I had the sense to stop short of "promised." "I can't." I was very angry, but I met neither anger nor apology in him. "Will you tell me why?" After a while he said, "Yes," and then paused again. During the pause, I began to think that an inept and undefended alien should not demand reasons from the Prime Minister of a kingdom, above all when he does not, and perhaps never will, understand the foundations of power and the workings of government in that kingdom. No doubt this was all a matter of Chief Grethor, prestige, face, place, the pride relationship, the untranslatable and all-important principle of social authority in Karhide and all civilizations of Gethin. And if it was, I would not understand it. "Did you hear what the king said to me at the ceremony today?"
"No."
Estravan leaned forward across the hearth, lifted the beer jug out of the hot ashes, and refilled my tankard. He said nothing more, so I amplified. "The king didn't speak to you in my hearing."
"Nor in mine," said he.
I saw at last that I was missing another signal. Damning his effeminate deviousness, I said, "Are you trying to tell me, Lord Estravan, that you're out of favor with the king?" I think he was angry then, but he said nothing that showed it, only,
"I'm not trying to tell you anything, Mr. I."
"My God, I wish you would." He looked at me curiously.
"Well, then, put it this way. There are some persons in court who are, in your phrase, in favor with the king, but who do not favor your presence or your mission here.
And so you're hurrying to join them, selling me out to save your skin," I thought. But there was no point in saying it. Estravan was a courtier, a politician, and I a fool to have trusted him. Even in a bisexual society, the politician is very often something less than an integral man. His inviting me to dinner showed that he thought I would accept his betrayal as easily as he committed it. Clearly face-saving was more important than honesty. So I brought myself to say, I'm sorry that your kindness to me has made trouble for you.
Coals of fire. I enjoyed a flitting sense of moral superiority, but not for long. He was too incalculable. He sat back so that the firelight lay ruddy on his knees and his fine, strong, small hands, and the silver tankard he held, but left his face in shadow. A dark face always shadowed by the thick, low-growing hair and heavy brows and lashes, and by a somber blandness of expression. Can one read a cat's face, a seal's, an otter's? Some Gathenians, I thought, are like such animals, with deep, bright eyes that do not change expression when you speak. I've made trouble for myself, he answered, by an act that had nothing to do with you, Mr. I. You know that Carhide and Orgorain have a dispute concerning a stretch of our border in the high north fall near Sassanoth. Agavan's grandfather claimed the Sinoth Valley for Carhide, and the commensals have never recognized the claim. A lot of snow out of one cloud, and it grows thicker. I've been helping some Carhidish farmers who live in the valley to move back east across the old border, thinking the argument might settle itself if the valley were simply left to the Orgota, who have lived there for several thousand years. I was in the administration of the North Fall some years ago, and got to know some of those farmers. I dislike the thought of their being killed in forays, or sent to voluntary farms in Orgorain. Why not obviate the subject of dispute? But that's not a patriotic idea. In fact, it's a cowardly one, and impugns the Shifgrethor of the king himself. His ironies and these ins and outs of a border dispute with Orgorain were of no interest to me. I returned to the matter that lay between us. Trust him or not, I might still get some use out of him. I'm sorry, I said, but it seems a pity that this question of a few farmers may be allowed to spoil the chances of my mission with the king. There's more at stake than a few miles of national boundary.
Yes, much more.
But perhaps the Ecumen, which is 100 light years from border to border, will be patient with us a while. The Stabiles of the Ecumen are very patient men, sir. They'll wait 100 years or 500 for Carhide and the rest of Geffen to deliberate and consider whether or not to join the rest of mankind. I speak merely out of personal hope and personal disappointment. I own that I thought that with your support—
I too.
Well, the glaciers didn't freeze overnight. Cliché came ready to his lips, but his mind was elsewhere. He brooded. I imagined him moving me around with the other pawns in his power game.
"You came to my country," he said at last, "at a strange time. Things are changing. We are taking a new turning. No, not so much that as following too far in the way we've been going. I thought that your presence, your mission, might prevent our going wrong, give us a new option entirely, but at the right moment, in the right place. It is all exceedingly chancy, Mr. I."
Impatient with the generalities, I said, "You imply that this isn't the right moment. Would you advise me to cancel my audience?"
My gaffe was even worse than Carhidish, but Estravan did not smile or wince. "I'm afraid only the king has that privilege," he said mildly.
"Oh, God, yes, I didn't mean that." I put my head in my hands a moment. Brought up in the wide-open, free-wheeling society of Earth, I would never master the protocol or the impassivity so valued by Carhiders. I know what a king was. Earth's own history is full of them, but I had no experiential feel for privilege, no tact. I picked up my tankard and drank a hot and violent draught. "Well, I'll say less to the king than I intended to say when I could count on you."
"Good."
"Why good?" I demanded.
"Well, Mr. I, you're not insane, I'm not insane. But then neither of us is a king, you see. I suppose that you intended to tell Argaven, rationally, that your mission here is to attempt to bring about an alliance between Gethen and the Ecumen. And rationally, he knows that already because, as you know, I told him. I urged your case with him, tried to interest him in you. It was ill done, ill-timed. I forgot, being too interested myself, that he's a king, and does not see things rationally but as a king. All I've told him means to him simply that his power is threatened. His kingdom is a dust mote in space. His kingship is a joke to men who rule 100 worlds. But the Ecumen doesn't rule. It coordinates. Its power is precisely the power of its member states and worlds. In alliance with the Ecumen, Qarhide will become infinitely less threatened and more important than it's ever been. Estrophen did not answer for a while. He sat gazing at the fire, whose flames winked, reflected, from his tankard and from one broad, bright silver chain of office over his shoulders. The old house was silent around us. There had been a servant to attend our meal, but Qarhiders, having no institutions of slavery or personal bondage, hire services, not people. And the servants had all gone off to their own homes by now. Such a man as Estrophen must have guards about him somewhere. For assassination is a lively institution in Qarhide, but I had seen no guard, heard none. We were alone. I was alone, with a stranger, inside the walls of a dark palace, in a strange, snow-changed city in the heart of the Ice Age of an alien world. Everything I had said, tonight and ever since I came to Winter, suddenly appeared to me as both stupid and incredible. How could I expect this man or any other to believe my tales about other worlds, other races, a vague, benevolent government somewhere off in outer space? It was all nonsense. I had appeared in Qarhide in a queer kind of ship, and I differed physically from Gethenians in some respects. That wanted explaining. But my own explanations were preposterous. I did not in that moment believe them myself. "I believe you," said the stranger, the alien alone with me. And so strong had my access of self-alienation been, that I looked up at him, bewildered. "I'm afraid that Argaven also believes you. But he does not trust you, in part because he no longer trusts me. I have made mistakes, been careless. I cannot ask for your trust any longer either, having put you in jeopardy. I forgot what a king is. Forgot that the king in his own eyes is Qarhide. Forgot what patriotism is, and that he is of necessity the perfect patriot. Let me ask you this, Mr. I. Do you know by your own experience what patriotism is?" "No," I said, shaken by the force of that intense personality suddenly turning itself wholly upon me. "I don't think I do. If by patriotism you don't mean the love of one's homeland, for that I do know. No, I don't mean love when I say patriotism. I mean fear, the fear of the other. And its expressions are political, not poetical. Hate, rivalry, aggression. It grows in us, that fear. It grows in us year by year. We've followed our road too far, and you, who come from a world that outgrew nations centuries ago, who hardly know what I'm talking about, who show us the new road—" He broke off. After a while he went on, in control again, cool and polite. "It's because of fear that I refuse to urge your cause with the king now. But not fear for myself, Mr. I. I'm not acting patriotically. There are, after all, other nations on Gethin." I had no idea what he was driving at, but was sure that he did not mean what he seemed to mean. Of all the dark, obstructive, enigmatic souls I had met in this bleak city, his was the darkest. I would not play his labyrinthine game. I made no reply. After a while he went on, rather cautiously, "If I've understood you, Your Eculon is devoted, essentially, to the general interest of mankind. Now, for instance, the Ogota have experience in subordinating local interests to a general interest, while Karhide has almost none. And the commensals of Orgorain are mostly sane men, if unintelligent, while the king of Karhide is not only insane, but rather stupid. It was clear that Estravan had no loyalties at all. I said in faint disgust, "It must be difficult to serve him, if that's the case." "I'm not sure I've ever served the king," said the king's prime minister, "or ever intended to. I'm not anyone's servant. A man must cast his own shadow." The gongs in Remney Tower were striking 6 hour, midnight, and I took them as my excuse to go. As I was putting on my coat in the hallway, he said, "I've lost my chance for the present, for I suppose you'll be leaving Erinrang." Why did he suppose so? "But I trust a day will come when I can ask you questions again. There's so much I want to know. About your mind speech in particular. You'd scarcely begun to try to explain it to me." His curiosity seemed perfectly genuine. He had the effrontery of the powerful. His promises to help me had seemed genuine, too. I said yes, of course, whenever he liked. And that was the evening's end. He showed me out through the garden, where snow lay thin in the light of Gethin's big, dull, rufous moon. I shivered as we went out, for it was well below freezing, and he said with polite surprise, "You're cold?" To him, of course, it was a mild spring night. I was tired and downcast. I said, "I've been cold ever since I came to this world." "What do you call it, this world, in your language?" "Gethin." "You gave it no name of your own?" "Yes, the first investigators did. They called it Winter." We had stopped in the gateway of the walled garden. Outside, the palace grounds and roofs loomed in a dark, snowy jumble lit here and there at various heights by the faint gold slits of windows. Standing under the narrow arch, I glanced up, wondering if that keystone, too, was mortared with bone and blood. Estravan took leave of me and turned away. He was never fulsome in his greetings and farewells. I went off through the silent courts and alleys of the palace, my boots crunching on the thin moonlit snow, and homeward through the deep streets of the city. I was cold, unconfident, obsessed by perfidy and solitude and fear. Chapter 2. The Place Inside the Blizzard. From a sound tape collection of North Karhidish hearth tales, in the archives of the College of Historians in Erinrang, narrator unknown, recorded during the reign of Argaven the Eighth. About 200 years ago, in the hearth of Shaff, in the Pering storm border, there were two brothers who vowed Kemmering to each other. In those days, as now, full brothers were permitted to keep Kemmer until one of them should bear a child. But after that, they must separate, so it was never permitted them to vow Kemmering for life. Yet this they had done. When a child was conceived, the Lord of Shath commanded them to break their vow and never meet in Kemmer again. On hearing this command, one of the two, the one who bore the child, despaired, and would hear no comfort or counsel, and, procuring poison, committed suicide. Then the people of the hearth rose up against the other brother and drove him out of hearth and domain, laying the shame of the suicide upon him. And since his own lord had exiled him, and his story went before him, none would take him in, but after the 3 days guesting, all sent him from their doors as an outlaw. So from place to place he went, until he saw that there was no kindness left for him in his own land, and his crime would not be forgiven. His transgression of the code controlling incest became a crime when seen as the cause of his brother's suicide. G.A. He had not believed this would be so, being a young man and unhardened. When he saw that it was so indeed, he returned over the land to Shath and, as an exile, stood in the doorway of the outer hearth. This he said to his hearth fellows there, I am without a face among men. I am not seen. I speak, and am not heard. I come, and am not welcomed. There is no place by the fire for me, nor food on the table for me, nor a bed made for me to lie in. Yet I still have my name. Getheren is my name. That name I lay on this hearth as a curse, and with it my shame. Keep that for me. Now nameless I will go seek my death. Then some of the hearthmen jumped up with shouts and tumult, intending to kill him, for murder is a lighter shadow on a house than suicide. He escaped them and ran northward over the land, towards the ice, outrunning all who pursued him. They came back all chapfallen to Shaf. But Getheren went on, and after 2 days' journey came to the Pering Ice. The Pering Ice is the glacial sheet that covers the northernmost portion of Karhide, and is, in winter when the Guthan Bay is frozen, contiguous with the Gobrin Ice of Orgorain. For 2 days he walked northward on the ice. He had no food with him, nor shelter, but his coat. On the ice nothing grows, and no beasts run. It was the month of Susmi, and the first great snows were falling those days and nights. He went alone through the storm. On the second day he knew he was growing weaker. On the second night he must lie down and sleep a while. On the third morning, waking, he saw that his hands were frostbitten and found that his feet were too, though he could not unfasten his boots to look at them, having no use left of his hands. He began to crawl forward on knees and elbows. He had no reason to do so, as it did not matter whether he died in one place on the ice or another, but he felt that he should go northward. After a long while the snow ceased to fall around him, and the wind to blow. The sun shone out. He could not see far ahead as he crawled, for the fur of his hood came forward over his eyes. No longer feeling any cold in his legs and arms, nor on his face, he thought that the frost had benumbed him. Yet he could still move. The snow that lay over the glacier looked strange to him, as if it were a white grass growing up out of the ice. It bent to his touch and straightened again like grass blades. He ceased to crawl and sat up, pushing back his hood so he could see around him. As far as he could see lay fields of the snowgrass, white and shining. There were groves of white trees with white leaves growing on them. The sun shone, and it was windless, and everything was white. Getheren took off his gloves and looked at his hands. They were white as the snow, yet the frostbite was gone out of them, and he could use his fingers and stand upon his feet. He felt no pain and no cold and no hunger. He saw a way over the ice to the north, a white tower like the tower of a domain, and from this place far away one came walking towards him. After a while Getheren could see that the person was naked. His skin was all white, and his hair was all white. He came nearer, and near enough to speak. Getheren said, Who are you? The white man said, I am your brother, and Kemmering, Hod. Hod was the name of his brother who had killed himself. And Getheren saw that the white man was his brother in body and feature, but there was no longer any life in his belly, and his voice sounded thin like the creaking of ice. Getheren asked, What place is this? Hod answered, This is the place inside the blizzard. We who kill ourselves dwell here. Here you and I shall keep our vow. Getheren was frightened, and he said, I will not stay here. If you had come away with me from our hearth into the southern lands, we might have stayed together and kept our vows lifelong, no man knowing our transgression. But you broke your vow, throwing it away with your life. And now you cannot say my name. This was true. Hod moved his white lips, but could not say his brother's name. He came quickly to Getheren, reaching out his arms to hold him, and seized him by the left hand. Getheren broke free and ran from him. He ran to the southward, and running, saw rise up before him a white wall of falling snow. and when he entered into it he fell again on his knees, and could not run but crawled. On the ninth day after he had gone up on the